We're about to be joined now by Edward Wyckoff Williams for the next few minutes on our program here. He's contributing editor at The Root, columnist, political analyst, appearing on Al Jazeera, MSNBC, CBS, Washington, and many national syndicated radio programs as well. And we're about to turn our attention to the affirmative action battle taking place before we enter the debate. Edward Wyckoff Williams, welcome back to the program. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you, buddy. So glad to be here.
So tell me, talk about your overview of where you think this case is, could be taking America. This is because we've seen affirmative action being whittled down over the years. So this could be a very significant case, depending on how this is voted upon. Well, there's 5-4.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
Well, it won't be a 5-4.
No, well, that's because she recused herself, right?
Because Elena Kagan was forced to recuse herself since she had worked on it as Solicitor General. And that really puts this in a precarious situation because, as we know, the court is more bent to conservatives at the moment. And they're reactionary conservatives, being led by Alito, but even Justice Roberts. These are people who actually want to make a conservative stance on the court and are ideologues in a lot of ways. And so I think that affirmative action might well be in danger. The fact that they actually even took the case after having upheld affirmative action in higher education in the 2003 Michigan case shows that they want to either reiterate the position or change the position, and that's quite dangerous. A part of what I wanted to do in my piece for The Root, talking about affirmative action, was to sort of peel back the layers of lies that have been told for years about what affirmative action has actually done. And I decided to take a historic view. I read and did a book review of a book by Joan Walsh, who's white, Irish-American, comes from a working-class family. She was the editor-in-chief of Salon.com and is now an MSNBC political analyst. And she did a brilliant book entitled What's the Matter with White People, the subtitle of which was Why Do We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was? And at the heart of the thesis of her book was, and by the way, Mark, you should get her on to talk about this if you haven't already, is that white Americans have been convinced by Republicans to believe that somehow black and brown people are getting stuff that they're not getting and have been living off the government dole, as it were. And she takes a historic view, looking at the post-World War II era, and looks at the GI Bill and Title IX, which allowed women equal access to higher education, FHA funding for mortgages, and she basically says that white Americans, particularly lower-income whites, were given affirmative action, essentially, to enter into the middle class, and that these programs, because discrimination and Jim Crow was still the law of the land, basically excluded black and brown people, but blacks in particular. And as a result, we've now had an entire generation, if not multiple generations, of white Americans who have experienced the best that that government affirmative action, government-sanctioned affirmative action, has to offer, while we still have a lagging demographic of African Americans and brown people who were, for all intents and purposes, shut out of that kind of progress, shut out of, quote-unquote, this golden age, right? And I think that when we even now look at the post-affirmative action era, the post-civil rights era, studies have shown consistently that white women have been the biggest beneficiaries of affirmative action. So I think it's sort of a cognitive dissonance of someone like an Abigail Fisher, who brought this case in Texas, to claim that she has been discriminated against. One, because someone like her is in a far better position to do well under these programs, but then two, it presumes that the seat that was not given to her, despite the fact she was not in the top 10% of her class, this seat that she thinks she deserved, she assumes was taken by a black or brown person, when it could have very well have been that the University of Texas chose another white student over her. But because of the way affirmative action has been perceived in the press and in society, it gives weight to the argument that she makes.
Edward, let me ask you really quickly. Justice Scalia made a whole bunch of comments recently, and he kind of categorized affirmative action as being a very easy decision for the court. along with several other things, same-sex marriage, a whole lot. What do you think? I mean, we know where he is on the issue. Why do you think he made those very clear comments about where he thinks the court's going to go?
Well, I think with the benefit of having Elena Kagan recuse herself, he might be completely confident. I mean, he knows his colleagues. You know, he sits and talks with Justice Roberts, who I think it's Roberts and Kennedy who might be the potential swing votes here. The fact that Justice Roberts voted in favor of Obamacare really now leaves this in play. But Kennedy seemed to be quite on the fence, I think, during the actual case. And so I think Scalia is a propagandist, first of all. So on some level, him putting that statement out is, I think, completely inappropriate as a justice sitting and talking about a case that has not yet been decided.
Most definitely.
But then when you look at him as the propagandist that he is, it would make complete sense because he's trying to push a narrative in the same way the Republican Party is trying to push a new narrative about Romney, trying to make him a moderate. They're trying to make it palpable for affirmative action to be dismantled. They want the greater general populace, that 63.7% of Americans who are white non-Hispanics, to believe that affirmative action has had its day, to believe that all the ills of slavery and Jim Crow have now been done away with. And it's almost the same argument that George Will made. This idea in his piece about basically Obama being an affirmative action president and the fact that his reelection would only be the result of his being black. It's this idea, this complete disconnect from reality, right, that somehow now being black is a benefit to people. Despite all the disparities that we see, particularly in criminal justice, as Mark and I have discussed, but all throughout education and housing, at every level of our society, black and brown people are disadvantaged. But yet, white conservatives want to push a narrative that the ills of the past no longer matter, that it's okay to fire Obama because the only reason he's really there is because he's black, and that it's okay to dismantle affirmative action policies in higher education because actually now we have black people and brown people taking the seats of worthy whites, even if they're not in the top 10% of their class. And for whatever reason, that's the only reason that this woman did not get in.
It is always a pleasure to have you with us, and we're looking forward to having you on for a much longer time very soon as this unfolds.
I wish I could take some calls right now because I would love to hear what the people out there in Baltimore are thinking. But thank you so much for having me, Mark. I really appreciate it.
We'll talk very soon, Edward.
Excellent. Take care.
Thanks.
Buddy.
Edward Wyckoff Williams. Give us an overview on his thoughts. Writes for Color The Root, and contributing editor at The Root. And it's always a pleasure to have him on the air with us. We're going to have a very brief break. And when Anthony and I return, we will be joined by Rachel Gotzel and Richard Kallenberg, who are going to debate the nature of affirmative action in America today with your calls at 410-319-8888. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, where they can help make your home more comfortable and energy efficient this winter. Did you know that October is National Energy Awareness Month? Right here in Maryland, the Maryland Department of Housing offers low-interest loans, rebates, and other resources for low-income qualified residents, all to improve the energy efficiency of your home. So warm up savings and your utility bill. Visit mdhousing.org or call 410-514-7530 for information or to see if you qualify. Anthony and I are going to continue our discussion on affirmative action. Rachel Gotzel joins us once again. She's co-founder and research director for the American Values Institute, a national consortium of social scientists, advocates, and law professors focusing on the role of implicit bias in law and policy. Rachel, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
I'm very happy to be here.
And Richard Kallenberg joins us as well. He's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, where he writes about a variety of education issues. And Richard Kallenberg, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
And join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Jump onto our Facebook pages and join the conversation there. But let us know what you think as this conversation unfolds. 410-319-8888. So let's start with what both of you think is at stake in this particular Supreme Court decision that is going to be made. I mean, because people have not. It's interesting. This case is not about class versus race, but it seems a lot of the sidebar discussions are about class versus race, and I don't know if that decision will affect that or not. But it has the potential of really affecting what we know as of affirmative action today. Richard, let me start with you, then we'll go to Rachel.
Sure. Well, I think the debate has been framed in terms of class versus race because that's the reality. In Texas, they had two sets of programs to provide affirmative action. One was the top 10% plan that reached out to low-income and working class and minority students as well as white students. If you're in the top 10% of your high school class, you're into UT Austin. In addition, they provided economic affirmative action, a leg up to low-income students of all races. Then the second affirmative action program is the more traditional one based on race, and that's what's being contested here. But the evidence suggests that if the court is to rule and constrain the use of the ability of universities and colleges to use race in admissions, universities, to their credit, will not give up on diversity. Instead, they are very likely to switch to providing a preference to low-income and working-class students of all races. We did a study of 10 leading universities where the use of race was dropped. And in almost all those cases, the universities shifted to a system that provides a preference across racial lines to needy students.
Rachel Gutzel?
I would disagree that this is about class versus race because that's just what it's about. I would argue that we should have affirmative action that includes an assessment of economic challenge, and I think we should have affirmative action that includes, among its many other factors, racial disadvantage. And I think that the primary reason this is about class versus race is because Rick chose to publish a study in which he argued that class-based affirmative action should be chosen over race-based affirmative action. And to me, that's a false binary. I think
What do you mean it's a false binary?
Well, because I think it is clear, A, that a holistic affirmative action policy like that at UT doesn't just look at race. Race is actually one of 12 factors that it looks at. Among the factors is clearly socioeconomic disadvantage. And so I think that, you know, again, I'm a working class woman myself. My dad was a roofer, so I'm all for the consideration of socioeconomic disadvantage. But again, I think we're not at a point in this country yet where we can simply jettison race and assume that we are going to have clear and, you know, sort of fair admissions processes. And I appreciate Rick's assessment of the different policies that have been implemented in those states in which race can't be used. But the number of African-American students at UCLA and UC Berkeley, for example, is abysmal. It's approximately 3%, 50% fewer than at the point where California could use race, among other factors. So I guess I feel like this case is really important for our continuing efforts toward diversity, and I hope that the justices understand that.
This is Anthony McCarthy. I just wanted to ask a very quick question. As we were reading some of the prep work today, explain to me and the listeners why this case and this particular student, who, when given the factors that we were reading about her, could very well have been rejected at the expense of another white student, although we really have no way of knowing that. She wasn't in the top percentile of her class, not the best student, did not have a resume that really included a lot of extracurricular activities, but to her credit, worked really hard, focused to get into that particular school. Why was her case the case used for this particular class of the court?
Well, I think that, you know, clearly the University of Texas publicly says it provides racial preferences in admissions.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a contest back and forth as to whether how she was affected. But clearly, you know, this was a case where a white student who was well qualified was not admitted, and it raises the larger issue. Let me just respond quickly, though, to my friend Rachel on a couple of points. And we have worked together on other issues, and I respect her a lot. On the question of whether we can do both, you know, why not just provide a leg up to low-income students and to African-American and Latino students. In theory, that could be possible. In practice, it doesn't happen. Careful research done by William Bowen and Anthony Carnevale, a lot of great researchers have found that selective universities provide quite large preferences based on race and no preference based on socioeconomic status. The one exception is when universities are barred from using race. And it's not that they suddenly care about poor kids. It's that they see socioeconomic affirmative action as a way to indirectly promote something that they do, to their credit, care about, which is racial diversity. The second point I'd make is that in our analysis, 7 of 10 universities that dropped the use of race and came up with alternatives were able to achieve the same level of diversity among African Americans and Latinos, or greater levels of diversity. Now, Rachel cited a couple of the exceptions, UC Berkeley, UCLA, and it's true. Representation of African Americans did decline there. But that doesn't tell us what would happen if there were a national rule put in place that you can't use race in admissions. For this reason, if you're a talented African American or Latino student, and you get into Berkeley or UCLA without a race preference, because they're banned from using race, you're probably also getting into, Stanford or other places that can still provide a race preference. And so we don't really have a good test of what would happen if at a place like UC Berkeley or UCLA, if everyone were playing on the same set of rules. Right now, UCLA and Berkeley are at a huge disadvantage in recruiting African-American and Latino students, given that they can't provide race preferences, but everyone else can.
So, Rachel, let me let you jump. Please do. They won't go to the phones. Please do.
Well, so again, Rick is correct that we've worked together before, and this is one area where we diverge. And it's interesting, Rick, that you noted Carnevale as a scholar upon whom your work is based, because actually, as you undoubtedly know, in their 2010 book chapter, Carnevale and Stroll expressly said that they disagree that we should cease to use race as among the factors in college admissions. In fact, they say, I'm quoting now, our analysis of NELS does not support the notion that we could use income or other socioeconomic characteristics as a substitute for race. Race and ethnicity have effects all their own, and we find socioeconomic status is no substitute. And I'd actually like to give some context for why that would be so.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason that I'm so sort of animated and passionate about this topic is because, as you noted, Mark, my work is rooted in the role of implicit bias and racial anxiety in sort of public policy and institutions and educational environments. And the more that I read, the more evident it is to me that race continues to be a barrier, particularly to African-American boys, but to African-American girls as well, in their educational opportunities in a way that is distinct from class. And so I read a new study today showing that holding everything constant, holding a child's, the assessment of a child's behavior constant, teacher ethnicity, other classroom factors, Black students are still significantly more likely than white students to receive office disciplinary referrals. Another study that I read recently, middle school teachers given an essay, same essay. In one instance, they think the essay is written by a white student. In another instance, they think it's written by either a Black or a Latino student. The middle school teacher, undoubtedly with no ill intent, gives constructive criticism to the white student, much less constructive criticism to the Black and Latino students. I could go on and on and on with the many instances in which Black and Latino students still don't have the same opportunities, don't sort of have the same path through our educational pipelines, even if they are reasonably affluent. And so we're still in a place where race matters, And in light of that, and again, sort of the fact that Rick and I agree that Carnevale is a researcher we should take seriously, it is evident that socioeconomic status at this point can't replace race as among the factors we use when we consider college admission.
Let me open the phones here. People calling in want to join this conversation. You just heard Rachel Gotzel, who is co-founder and research director of the American Values Institute, a national consortium of social scientists, advocates, and law professionals focusing on the role of implicit bias in law and policy. She also works for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in Manhattan. Richard Kallenberg is senior fellow at the Century Foundation, where he writes about a variety of education issues as we tackle this latest discussion America's having around affirmative action because of the case before the Supreme Court. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Jump onto our Facebook. And Joe in Bethesda, you're on the air.
What?
Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm sorry. I wasn't sure.
That's all right.
My name is Joe, and I actually attended one of these schools that was described here, and I don't want to say which one. I got my doctorate, and I noticed that there is just no diversity. There was no diversity in my classes, zero. Occasionally, the later classes, maybe they had one or two minority students. And to me, if I'm going to be a physician, and I want to try and treat different people from different backgrounds, I want to see something in the class that embodies the rest of the U.S. That's just my point of view. You know, I just don't see that in higher education, not just in college, but in professional school. You really see the big disparity between the races, however you want to state this. But to me, I guess I see it as a lack of opportunity because of financial circumstances or because of what the lady is speaking towards, that there is this inherent bias, especially early on in education, as to how students are treated, whether they're female or whether they're minorities. There's always this big gap once people enter professional school or when they become senior staff or, you know, when they become the heads of departments, you don't see this diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts early on. And I just wanted to mention that from my point of view as a former student at one of these schools. And I love my alma mater, but at the same time, I would want
right.
to see more diversity.
That's a really interesting statement you made. And let's wrestle with that. I mean, I think that it really does beg the question, Rick Kallenberg, that Rachel raised earlier and what our caller's talking about here. Are we at a point where we cannot jettison race? It was interesting to find that former Supreme Justice O'Connor was in the audience, almost as if she was staring down the other justices and saying, I know you're not going to overturn my ruling. So, and so.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was there in the court, too, and I have to tell you the questioning was very, very tough from the conservatives on the court. Listen, I would. You know, you'd have to be crazy to say that racial bias doesn't continue to afflict our society. But that's not the argument. That's never been an argument that the Supreme Court has accepted as a basis for racial preferences. They've never said that because discrimination occurs in our society, therefore we can, in college admissions, kind of reverse those roles and provide a racial preference against white and Asian students. Instead, the argument is that we should have, it's important educationally to have diversity. And I completely agree with that. We want our institutions to be racially diverse, ethnically diverse, and economically diverse. The question becomes, how do you get there in a manner that is legal, that has political support, and that will work and be fair? And Justice Alito, with whom I agree on very few issues, asked a very pointed question at the hearing. He said, you know, why is it that Texas is trying to give the very wealthiest students of color a preference over low-income students of all races? I mean, that's kind of the dirty little secret of higher education. There are 25 times as many rich kids as poor kids on these selective campuses. So what they've done is they've said, well, let's have rich kids of all colors. Well, that's not genuine diversity. We need to go much further than that and make sure that we have racial and ethnic diversity, but also economic diversity. In terms of the, you know, Rachel's point about Tony Carnevale, she's absolutely right that his policy conclusion is that he would like to see a continuation of race and class. I edited the book in which he wrote that chapter. But at the same time, he finds in his research that today socioeconomic obstacles are seven times as large as racial obstacles to doing well. So if we were to have a fair meritocratic system, we would want to provide large preference to students who've overcome economic obstacles and consider race at the very end of the process in a minor way. And universities do exactly the opposite of that. They provide very large preferences on the order of 300 SAT points for African Americans and very modest to non-existent preferences based on class.
So, Rachel, let me ask you to pick up on that. I'm really, and then I'm going to go back to the phones here. Bruce and Eugene are online. I want to get them on before the end of the hour. At least them, if not more. But this is something that really is grabbing America, I think, at its heart, and both in the white and black communities, other communities, just this question of class versus race, and class and or race, especially with Barack Obama saying that I don't think my daughters should be able to get in college with affirmative action because of their class and the school they went to. So can you balance this out?
Absolutely. I think it's absolutely absurd to suggest that every single African-American or Latino student who applies to UT is given a racial preference. That's not the way their program works. And their program works so that they evaluate. You have two race-blind readers of essays. You consider leadership potential. You consider work experience. You consider sort of volunteerism. Then you consider special characteristics. Among those characteristics, and there are seven, may be race. So the notion that somehow every single black student who applies to UT is a beneficiary of a racial preference is absurd. And I would go back to what our caller Joe said, which I think is really important, and it goes to something Rick raised, which is what is the legal justification for affirmative action? And the legal justifications are two. Justification is primarily one, diversity. And the diversity that Justice Powell referenced in Bakke, which benefits the whole class. And that's exactly what Joe just described. He suggested that his education was impoverished because there were too few African Americans and Latinos in his class. And it sounds like he's a doctor, and it sounds like he thinks his education as a doctor would have been a better one if he had had a more multiracial set of classmates, and he's right. The second point I would make is, what is at issue? What the court debated at length at the argument is what constitutes a critical mass. And it's actually very interesting. The concept of critical mass comes from social dynamics, and the definition is you have a critical mass when there's a sufficient number of adopters of an innovation so that the rate of adoption becomes self-sustaining and creates further growth. And I take that to mean we know we have critical mass when there are the numbers of African American and Latino students in higher education, so that we are creating professionals of every race and ethnicity, and so that our society doesn't continue to have the kinds of implicit biases and discriminatory actions that I described. And so I think that, again, Rick, we agree on a lot, and we in fact agree on the fact that universities have absolutely been irresponsible in sort of failing to give the kind of socioeconomic preferences you're suggesting or to pay careful attention to economic heterogeneity. I completely agree with you on that. Where we diverge is that we should choose one versus the other. Because I think, and frankly, I think this debate will be a useful one, because whatever happens with this case, and I will give her credit for this, whatever happens with the Fisher case, I think that the scrutiny is now on selective institutions to work harder and to do more to ensure that poor and working class kids have the opportunity to go to colleges. And again, should that happen, I think Rick can be among the people who takes credit for that. But I think if that happens sort of in lieu of any kind of reference to a focus on racial diversity, we are all going to be worse off.
Let me open the phones again, and I'm going to tell the listeners we're calling. We only have like 5 or 6 minutes left, so I'm going to keep your responses a little short so we can let our guests respond to you. Bruce in Southeast, you're on the air.
Yeah. First off, I don't mean any disrespect to your guests, but the academics always complicate things so ridiculous. They never keep things simple. But so here's the thing. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, one of his my favorite quotes in his is to be judged by the content of your character. I agree with that. So I know and understand that people of color and minorities have been held down and haven't been given opportunities. I understand that. But sometimes it gets a little ridiculous that if you really believe that, what he said, if you really believe the content of your character, a person should really only make it on their ability. Racial preferences shouldn't be that important. If you're talented, if you're skilled, if you have the drive, the imagination, more power to you, whatever race, whatever culture you are. But I don't think in this day and age that racial preference should be a deciding factor.
Okay, now Bruce, as I said, we have to make these short, so we don't have much time. And Rachel, I like this. This is the part of the crux of the issue here, where affirmative action and the idea kind of goes against the grain of some traditional American thought about doing it on your own.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's actually interesting is I don't think Rick and I disagree that none of us do it on our own. According to the caller, and sir, I respect the notion that sort of, you know, we as Americans all do think that our efforts should be rewarded. But what Rick is suggesting is we should give poor kids and working class kids a leg up because there's some obstacles in their way, and to ensure that we, you know, that everyone gets an opportunity, we should give a leg up. The rich kids these days, the SAT prep courses, the, you know, sort of extraordinary amount of extra efforts that they get to get them ready to compete for college, I'm sorry, I don't think any of them can say they're doing it on their own. I don't think any of us can. We're all beneficiaries of something extra, whether it's from our family's wealth or from something else. So I think that the idea is actually to make the playing field fair.
Quick comment from Eugene in Nottingham, then we're going to have to leave. Eugene, you're on the air. We don't have much time. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, this will be quick. I just want to say that I think the young lady and the guy both on the same side, in a sense, they're both making good points. The one thing that the young lady said that I think is extremely important, though, is that when you're dealing with neutral papers written by students of different ethnic groups, and if a teacher knew that it was a black student writing one paper and a white student writing another paper, knew in advance and gave different critiques or different breakdowns, that says a lot right there. The bottom line is that race may not be as big a factor as it was 30 years ago, but it's still a factor. And how much of a factor now, you know, it's very subjective. But I think what can't be denied is that there is a factor that it has to be considered. And I think when you get to a point where people don't want to consider it as much, I think that's very dangerous.
Eugene, thank you so much. And Rick, we literally have about a minute and a half left. You want to have a quick thought on that?
Sure. Let me follow up on one thing that Bruce said about Martin Luther King, because King did struggle with this issue of affirmative action in his 1964 book, Why We Can't Wait. He makes an argument that, you know, throughout our history, we've discriminated against African Americans, and there is compensation due. But then, interestingly, he pivots and says, we ought to have not a Bill of Rights for blacks, per se, but a Bill of Rights for the economically disadvantaged. And there are two insights here. One is that any program that's going to help low-income and working-class people will disproportionately benefit students of color and people of color. And that's as it should be. That given our history of discrimination in this country, there is compensation due, and you can do it through an economic lens. The other piece, which David Leonhardt quoted in the New York Times on Sunday, is that King knew that there would be a huge backlash from white working class people if benefits were provided simply based on race, even to the most advantaged people of color. And so, to my mind, that's kind of the irony here, is we're going to have a conservative Supreme Court that will curtail the use of race and lead us to something better, an affirmative action based on class.
So, Rachel, close out with our last 30 seconds, would you, as we leave this for today?
I think that the idea that somehow we can take Martin Luther King's words to suggest that he would disagree with affirmative action in light of, as the caller described, and as all these reports that I read described, and as experiences of people I know, there continues to be an issue of race. It is just not the case that providing socioeconomic affirmative action will ensure that we have a sufficient number of students of color in higher education. And if sort of we can't underestimate the effect it will have on our society if suddenly we lose a decent degree of diversity in our selective institutions.
I want to thank both of you for joining Anthony McCarthy and I here during this half an hour. We'll come back to the subject. This is really an important subject for us all, and you two really handled it very well. I appreciate your time, Rachel Gotzel and Rick Kallenberg, and we will have links to their work on our website, SanoShow.org. Rachel and Rick, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you
so much.
Been a pleasure. Anthony and I are going to take a brief break and come back. We're going to go
local,
and we'll be talking with John Wagner from The Post, Alexander Piles from The Daily Record at the top of the hour about the referendum campaign spending and what's been going on there. But then we're going to be talking to Luke Broadwater from the Baltimore Sun, who's been just put out a new breaking news story at 5:41 on the Sun papers about Angelos handling the Pratt lawsuit against the mayor and paying for it all. So we'll talk about all that coming up the next half hour. Don't go away.